Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Computer Weekly Downtime Upload podcast. I'm Cliff Saren, and my guest today is the dot-com innovator and strategist David Holtzman, who previously worked as IBM chief scientist and is the designer of the global DNS system. David, thank you very much for being here today on the podcast. I know you have recently taken up a new role at Naoris Protocol, but let's just get things started, if I may, by asking you to give us a little background about yourself, how you keep yourself busy, and what you do in your spare time, please.
Sure. I have a sort of an unusual background, like a lot of people in the internet, I think. I started a long time ago as a philosophy teacher. I got a degree in philosophy. I taught. This is many, many years ago. And then I needed to make money, and I got involved with the U.S. military and ended up doing intelligence work. So I was an intelligence agent for several years. They taught me to speak Russian. I became a cryptographer at the end of the Cold War, and I was a submariner, and spent quite a few years traveling to unusual places on submarines, doing what you might think a Russian-speaking cryptographer might do on a submarine. And I went from there to the National Security Agency. I was a cosmonaut analyst. But during all this period, I got more degrees in computer science and math and other things. But the common element in all this was information and computers. So this was back in the early 80s at this point, and I got fascinated with computers. I left everything I was doing and started working for computer companies in the Washington, D.C. area. I was a programmer in a lot of different languages. I became a designer, project manager, software architect. I was the systems administrator for TRW. And then I eventually was at Booz Allen running their research group. And I designed a heterogeneous data access system. And I built it on a NeXT computer.
I remember reviewing one in the sort of early 90s. It was my very first job. And this beautiful black box turned up on my desk.
It's still the most beautiful computer I've ever used. And I gave a I was at a trade show. Steve Jobs walked by. He was impressed with what I had done. Had his guys grab my computer, bring it on the stage, and I became part of a televised keynote, which didn't hurt my career any. And I got heavily involved with NeXT for a number of years. Got to know Steve. Brought our customers onto NeXT, which was mostly intelligence agencies. And then I, when NeXT sort of tanked and Steve went to Apple, I moved on and sold my stuff to IBM. I became the chief scientist of the Internet Information Group. I built the search engine that went into something at the time called Lotus Notes. And then at this point, we're in the mid-90s. The Internet is clearly starting up commercially and going somewhere. I had a ton of job offers because of my background, and I chose to go to a small, very small, sleepy company called Network Solutions in Herndon, Virginia, because they had the contract to run the domain name system. Also the TCP/IP system for North America and the entire cellular data system. So, you know, back then, that wasn't that big a deal. There were only about 50, 60,000 domain names. So I came on as senior VP of technology and then became CTO, and it blew up. And this was the beginning of the dot-com bubble. It went from 50, 60,000 domain names to, by the time I left in at the end of 2001, we had 10 million domain names.
Wow.
So our company went public. We were in the middle of the maelstrom of all the controversy involving the dot-com world.
Yes.
So I got a taste of all this, and I got to know a lot of the people. I made a little bit of money. And one of the things that I got out of that experience was that the internet was about to become a bit of a scary place. And the scary part for me, and this is probably what I'm going to be talking about today. The scary part was the desire of people who didn't know what they were doing to regulate something that they didn't understand.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this started creating the true problems with privacy, a lack of understanding of what security means, that kind of thing. I wrote a couple of books. I wrote a book called Privacy Lost about this stuff. It's still being taught in law schools. I wrote a book called Surviving Identity Theft. I helped, I know this is a long-winded answer, but hopefully it'll give you stuff. I helped run two U.S. presidential campaigns, one's the CTO, one is chief security officer. And for the last 6 or 7 years, I've been working with blockchain companies, helping, not doing the cryptocurrencies as much, but I'm fascinated with the very idea of a blockchain because it's actually quite subversive when you look at what it does. And I like that. Mm. And I met Naoris Protocol. I met David Carvalho, the CEO. I loved what he was doing. The philosophy of the company fits mine. And I'm just like the people and I'm fascinated with it.
Okay, well, I mean, you've spoken quite a lot about what was going to be in my first question, actually, about, you know, the past. It was about the past of the internet, you know, where things have come from. And also you've touched on some of the concerns, but let's just drill down a bit. And particularly, I just want to pick up on what you were saying about your concern around blockchain, if
sure.
I may.
Yep. Well, the it's not concern, it's kind of attraction, I guess. Mm. So that one of the nice things about the concept of a blockchain is anything you put on a blockchain is fundamentally immutable. Mm. I mean, there are ways of messing with it by changing the indices to locate it, but basically a data object committed to a blockchain is going to stay on that blockchain. And that's the first interesting thing. The second interesting thing about blockchain is that you can assign control or ownership or whatever word you want to use of that data object to anybody by exchanging cryptographic tokens.
Mm.
That's kind of interesting too. And, you know, for lots of reasons we can talk about. And then the third thing wasn't part of Bitcoin, but it came in with Ether, which is the idea of smart contracts. And that for me was the killer for blockchains, because it allows us as consumers and citizens to mostly not need lawyers and government people quite as much as we used to. We can ratify our own agreements and we don't need to pay someone to do it for us.
Oh, I see. Okay. Why do you think there is so much interest in that idea that, you know, we're able to ratify our own agreements, you know, given that, you know, looking at, you know, the institutions that exist today, the banks and you know, you mentioned obviously the lawyers for the contracts, these are things that have existed for a long time and people are used to that way of transacting. So why is there so much interest in getting around these things that already exist?
Well, I think that the interest in getting around it is it's a minority, but it's a very intelligent, articulate, and loud minority. So we hear from them a lot.
Hmm.
I think the majority of the people are like the status quo, and they're afraid of things that are different. And to some extent, that's generational and age related, but I think it's an innate human reaction. I think genuinely creative people thrive on chaos, because to some extent, I would define creativity as the art of making something interesting out of chaos. So if you even remotely believe that, if you don't have chaos, you're probably not having a lot of creativity going on. You know, if you ever have little kids and you want to get them to do something really interesting, take a whole bunch of random stuff and dump it in a pile on the floor, and it's amazing what they do.
Hmm.
It's that's how I view the internet right now. I think that we're not done. It's just really just beginning in a lot of ways. And we'll talk about AI, I think, which is sort of interesting right now.
We probably will, actually. But before we do, and I just wanted to, you know, just explore a bit more about the internet itself. And, you know, when you were introducing yourself, you spoke about, you know, the protocols, the IP protocol, TCP/IP, in fact, and other things like that. And obviously we have the DNS. Just generally, and now we're speaking about, you know, the blockchain and Bitcoin. But what do you think we can learn from the longevity of these protocols?
Well, one thing is, let's generalize this to technology. One thing is that there's always resistance to a new technology, but once it's adopted, it's virtually impossible to get rid of it. And there's a lot of, and I think if you apply that to what's going on today, you can make some pretty good future predictions. So in England, for instance, the width of a lane on a highway is exactly the width of the axle of a Roman chariot. And that is not a coincidence. And the reason is because people just build a road in a town and then a highway, and nobody wants to rock the status quo. This is a protocol.
Yes.
So you always want backward compatibility. And in this case, we're talking, you know, 1,000 years. When the DOS computers first started, the Microsoft types running MS-DOS, there was a thing in the operating system that restricted the size of a data object to 64K. That limitation is still basically in Windows. It's a fake limitation. It actually started, I think, in MS-DOS or in a Dr. DOS even before MS-DOS. But it's a limitation. It's sort of a protocol, and it's been around for 25 years because it's too much work to change it. So that's why a good modern example is TCP/IP, which you brought up. TCP/IP has been around. I would argue that it is the beginning of the internet, and it was what we call IPv4. So IPv6 was agreed on 20 some years ago. And you know what? Nobody's really using it yet.
Really?
And it's not even. I just looked at my own ISP this morning. Verizon, who's one of the biggest ones in this part, and they still don't support IPv6. So it's some smaller ISPs do, some don't. It's more curiosity. It has not been adopted. The DNS system, the domain name system, there was a protocol called DNSSEC that was agreed on about 25 years ago, and it was a way of carrying cryptographic identification information at each node in the DNS tree. And you know what? That's still not being used. The DNS system has fundamentally no security whatsoever, even today. If you have even the remotest idea what you're doing, you could sit in a hotel room with a laptop and take entire countries off the internet.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often, actually.
I know that, you know, countries have taken certain domains off the internet. You know, there are examples of where YouTube was switched off in certain regions of the world at certain times and things like that. But would this DNSSEC have made that much more difficult to do?
Not against this country. It's more about spoofing and stopping DNS spoofing. The country thing is a whole different problem. So the DNS system is a big tree structure, right?
Yes.
So you have a thing called the root at the dot at the very top. In fact, I have a computer in my house that was the dot during the dot-com bubble, which is kind of interesting. And it doesn't look like much, but it basically ran the internet for a couple of years. So the DNS system is a big tree. So a country can get in at some point and mess with the tree at a level they control and everything below. So in China, for instance, they have what they call the Great the great internet wall in China.
Yes.
So they can control everything under, you know, their own TLD, their own top-level domain. The problem comes in, how do they deal with something that isn't in their control, such as, say, Google.com, if they wanted, which they did, actually. They wanted to suppress that.
Yes.
Because Google's not going to let them do it. And the .com top-level domain and the .dot itself are run by ICANN, and they're not going to let China do it. So in that case, since they can't do it in the DNS system, they do it by blocking TCP/IP addresses at routers in major ISPs coming into the country. So it's not a really good. It's not a good solution. It's just what they all use now.
It's as simple as that. And we can do that on our own home router, can't we? We can block IP addresses.
Right, and then if you have, but you can get around that and. VPNs. I mean, I was in Tibet a couple of years before the pandemic, and they were blocking everything in sight, including Google. And I had things I wanted to do, and I tested it. So I brought a couple of VPNs and some equipment with me, and I was always able to get around their suppression because, you know, if you think about how they're doing that, they're blocking, as I said, blocking IP addresses that come from known places. But I switched over and I started using servers on the Isle of Man, and they hadn't really thought about that, so that that connection went through.
Yeah, so I mean, we are sort of talking quite a lot about security at the moment, and what do you think needs to be done to make the internet more secure? I know that's a how long is a piece of string, what can we do, but I mean, surely we should be doing more than we are already doing.
Well, there's a couple levels in which I can answer this. At one level, security, the right way to think about security, cybersecurity, is it's not a binary thing. You're not either secure or not secure. Privacy's that way too. It's on the spectrum. You know, it's a continuum, right?
Yes.
And it's an inverse geometric cost thing. It's like an inverted parabola. So the more secure you want to be, the more it costs you. But it's not linear, it's geometric. So network uptime is the same exact way. So the more secure you want to be, the more and more money you have to throw at it. And when you look at that curve and you put money on it, there's a point where executives of companies simply don't want to spend that extra money. And that point's pretty quick usually, so they don't. Because there's no real penalty for them, at least in the United States. I mean, we've had just massively egregious data breaches. I mean, the Equifax, you know, the credit bureau company, they nailed, I think, one out of every two or three Americans in the whole country, and they got slapped with a very, very minimal fine. So if the downside is trivial, why would you spend $500 million to improve your security? That's actually an issue for regulation, but that's one level of security. But drilling down another layer, the fundamental problem is that the way the internet and all of computers are designed and built and operating systems, and it's fundamentally insecure. The von Neumann machine architecture that we've used since the beginning of computers is a massively insecure architecture because there's no protection for memory spaces. So most hacks come from taking advantage of this, that a memory location that looks like it's data, like you just typed your name in a field somewhere and it goes into a variable somewhere in a program, that address could also be part of the operating system or it could be a machine instruction. So if you can confuse the computer and instead of reading it as your name, it reads it as a bunch of code and executes it. Guess what? You've just hacked the computer.
So you're talking. You're talking about like a buffer overflow attack.
I was just going to say that.
Yes.
That is exactly what a buffer overflow is. So that stuff is so inherent to the architecture of way these things are built. We would have to start over again. So the only way to make things truly secure would be to throw everything out and start over with the idea of security. But when computers were first started, when TCP/IP was built, when the C and C++ languages were built, nobody thought that we were going to be at the point we are today, where you have trillions of dollars at stake based on security issues, or they would have probably built it differently. So then I go back to my Roman chariot analogy. Do I think we're going to throw all this stuff out and start over? There's not a chance in hell. So we're stuck with what we have, and people 50 years from now will have all kind of weird, you know, protocols, and they won't understand where they came from. It's going to be because their legacy from today.
Yes.
So if you go into a browser and you play around with the HTTP protocol, there's like ridiculous things that it will accept because it made sense 30 years ago. Like you can type in Archie or Waze with a colon and a slash slash, and then put Archie used to be a kind of a search engine. And you can put that in right into the command line, and it'll accept it because it's a legacy thing.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I just want to go back and drill down a little bit on the microprocessors, because you know, they, I know, say, you know, in, like in the Windows operating system, you can do like the memory protect thing. I don't know specifically what they call it, and it sort of does a flag in the operating system and somehow stops, in theory,